You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Well, it is great to have all of you here today to share in Robin's message. And I wanted to tell you a little bit about Robin's background. Many of you have seen that we've been doing our best to prepare people for Robin. We've shared with you that Phyllis Tickle has called him brilliant. Look at him. I mean, it's obvious. Phyllis Tickle is the one who a number of years ago, I've quoted her a lot. She's the one that says, you know, every 500 years or so, the church has to go through the big rummage sale and sell off all the stuff that it doesn't want anymore, and that we're in the middle of that right now. So Robin is one of the barkers at our rummage sale, recommending things to get rid of. Walter Brueggemann, no less, has called him witty and disarming. And Archbishop Desmond Tutu, no less, calls him pastoral and prophetic, which you're going to get a little bit of today. I just want to share with you that it was a great privilege for me to share the back cover of a book with Robin from a few years ago. Our friend and colleague Brandon Scott, who's a member of the Jesus Seminar and teaches at Phillips in Tulsa, he was publishing his new book, The Trouble with Resurrection, a book which has gotten me in trouble. And so Brandon asked me to do an endorsement on the back of the book, which was my first book endorsement. I was like, oh my gosh, yeah, so it was great. So you can imagine how fast and furiously I opened up the package when the book arrived to see my name on the back of the book. And so there it was, you know, David Felton, you know, blah, 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 by this book, David Felton, Living the Questions, blah, blah, blah. Right below that was Robin Myers. And he said, you know, same thing, buy this book or else kind of thing, Reverend Dr. Robin Myers. But the thing is, Robin had just published his new book, Saving Jesus from the Church, which we have copies of available right here. And Polebridge Press is kind of notorious for having glitches and not being very good at correcting their copy. And this was just perfect because it said that instead of Robin Myers being the author of Saving Jesus from the Church, he was the author of Saving the Church from Jesus. And so I'll let you be the judge here in a minute as to whether he has been able to do that or not. So what we're going to do for our reading today is we're going to do the voice version of our reading. And so if normally we have a variety of different people read. So today you guys are going to be the Pharisees, okay? And it goes like this. We're looking at Luke 13, 31 to 35. And I'm going to give you the intro, and it's just like our other readings. I'm going to be the narrator, and then you guys are the Pharisees, and then Denise is going to be Jesus. Oh, Emily's going to be Jesus. Oh, much more typecasting. Okay, good. All right, so here we go. Now, get your best Pharisee voice on. Are you ready? Okay. Right then, some Pharisees came and warned him.
You can give that sly fox this message. Watch as I cast out demons and perform healings today and tomorrow. And on the third day, I'll reach my destination. But for today and tomorrow and the next day, I have to continue my journey. For no prophet should perish outside of Jerusalem. O Jerusalem, O Jerusalem, you kill the prophets and you stone the messengers who are sent to you. How often I wanted to gather in your children as a hen gathers in her chicks under her wings. But you were not willing to come to me. Look now, your house is abandoned and empty. You won't see me until you welcome me with the words of the Psalms. Anyone who comes in the name of the Eternal One will be blessed. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
Thank you all so much for having me here and being willing to listen to me. When I get home, they'll ask me where I was because they're getting confused by how many places I go, and I'm just going to say I was at that church. I have a theory about how nations get to an unacceptable place and then wonder how they got there. It happens by a rule I call incremental apathy. And to my way of thinking, this is the worst form of political correctness. Here's how it works. The powers that be take small bites off the body of freedom, just large enough bites to add up to something over time, but small enough to seem like something we should just agree to disagree about. At each step, those who run the world and need to control other people to do it express outrage at any and all dissent as the resentful whining of the unpatriotic or the socialist, or in the language of a neo-fascist now running for president, a loser. And this has the intended effect, which is to silence those who know that the incremental is exactly how we eventually arrive at the unacceptable. Here's how it works. Some examples. Gerrymander all your voting districts to keep one party or the other in power, and you will arrive at a permanent political class that does not answer to real people, only to monolithic constituencies. If you oppose a woman's right to choose an abortion, you chip away at all the necessary conditions that make that option available until it's no longer available. If minorities are an obstacle to your political power, you pass photo ID laws at polling places just to make sure that non-existent voter fraud is not occurring. And you make it harder to vote early or to vote by mail. And so while looking like a champion for honest elections, you manage to achieve more rigged elections. If you hate unions, you don't come right out and say, "I hate unions and I would like them crippled so we can pay less for labor." But rather you appear to be incensed at the idea that dues are required from everyone if everyone is to benefit from collective bargaining. You pretend to care about the freedom of workers not to belong to unions that you would prefer did not exist to begin with, and incrementally, you achieve the gutting of unions. If you want to pass all your wealth along to your children, the wealth you've hidden in some offshore accounts in the Cayman Islands, you make sure that your congressman or senator that you own performs for you by not outlawing this, what is truly unpatriotic. When I was a kid, we called it a free ride. While you make sure that more and more of the wealth that really will ruin your kids is not taxable when you die. Most wealthy people in this country inherit their wealth and then often lecture the rest of us on how wealth works and how jobs are created. If you love the Constitution, except when it gets in the way of your agenda, you'll cite the Second Amendment as if it were holy writ, but not the part about a president's responsibility to select a Supreme Court nominee to fill a sudden vacancy that you would love to have filled and would argue must be filled according to the Constitution if the president were just a member of your party and would appoint your kind of nominee. You see, when obstructionism is incremental and we forget how toxic it is, the cumulative result is a completely dysfunctional Congress, followed now almost certainly by a dysfunctional Supreme Court. Pundits, of course, will wonder, how did we get here? And the answer is, we got here in small steps that we were bullied into accepting and then woke up in a country we didn't recognize. Okay, you just wonder, is this going to be a political diatribe, or is there going to be anything here about the gospel and the text, or is this just Robin, you know, blowing in, blowing off, and blowing out? Actually, the answer is the text is what drove me here. It's called the Lament Over Jerusalem. Can you hear the lament in my voice over this land that I love? I love it. This great experiment in democracy, I just feel it slipping away. Herod is coming to get Jesus, and Jesus does not hold a press conference to announce a new campaign strategy. He does not think to himself, perhaps I should cool my jets, throttle back, avoid Jerusalem, work the suburbs where the swing voters are. No. This Jesus, sold to us by an impotent church as meek and mild, gentle as a child, says, "Go and tell that fox for me. Listen, I'm casting out demons and performing cures today and tomorrow, and on the third day I finish my work," kind of a reference by Luke to the resurrection. "Yet today," says Jesus, "tomorrow and the next day, I must be," listen carefully, "on my way, because it is impossible for a prophet to be killed outside of Jerusalem. I must be on my way, not after I've read the latest polls, not after I've called Herod disgraceful for questioning my religion, after which I will expediently backtrack and say, 'Oh, don't get me wrong, I like Herod. I like him, really nice guy, good personality, great shoes. We can work together. I'm a uniter, not a divider.' Jesus sounds like someone who has work to do, a message to spread, people to heal, and an empire to poke in the eye, and he does not intend to do it incrementally until someone wakes up one morning and says, 'Honey, I think the kingdom has come.' Jesus says, 'It's here now, the kingdom. This is what it looks like. Come and get me if you like, just as you've come to get all the other prophets, but don't try to subvert my mission incrementally or soften my message so that you can claim that your real concern is national security or domestic tranquility or that tired old bromide, that what's good for Rome is good for Palestine and all that. I must be on my way. That is not meek and mild. And since it's about who has the power, how is it exercised, and to what effect, this is both political and uncompromising. It's the church today that is meek and mild. Just consider this. Protestants these days have to depend upon the Pope to be prophetic." So let's begin at the beginning. Did you notice that Jesus gets his warning from the Pharisees? "At that very hour, some Pharisees came and said to him, 'Get away from here, for Herod wants to kill you.'" Well, wait a minute. I thought all the Pharisees were anti-Jesus and hypocrites and a brood of vipers. It would appear that some Pharisees want to warn Jesus that his life is in danger. Unless you accept the more cynical view of some scholars that they're just pretending to be concerned, but they're really doing Herod's bidding. I don't know. I'm going to give these Pharisees, what we call at Mayflower, the BOD, the benefit of the doubt, and remind you that Jesus referred to some Pharisees as hypocrites, not all Pharisees. Some are indeed his adversaries. They try to trick him with loaded questions, but Nicodemus was a Pharisee, the one who came to Jesus by night for some tutoring. How can a grown man re-enter the womb and be born again? You see, Nicodemus was a literalist. That was his problem. But he was trying to graduate. And then there was Gamaliel, who warned his fellow Jews not to take action against these Jesus followers, because what if what Jesus said is true is really true? We might end up on the wrong side of something born of God. So long before George Harrison wrote the song, Gamaliel said, "Let it be." Because in the end, if this is God's project, it's going to succeed. If not, it will fail. "By their fruits you shall know them." So here are some Pharisees warning Jesus to flee from the wrath that's to come. Herod was the Vladimir Putin of his day, a murderous and expedient politician whose mission is to keep order and snuff out insurrections. He's protecting his own job, of course, because like all of us, he too can be replaced. The son of Herod the Great, Herod Antipas, the Tetrarch of Galilee, seems to have spent much of his life running scared. For example, when John the Baptist started criticizing his private life in public, Herod had him locked up for fear that otherwise he might become too popular. But he didn't kill him for fear that his followers would revolt. On his birthday, Herod told Salome that he'd give her anything if she'd just do that dance, you know, the one with the seven veils. And when what she asked for after the dance was John's head on a plate, he had to keep his word or risk looking weak. Now there's a new prophet running around named Jesus, and some people said he's John the Baptist come back from the dead. And so Herod sends out word that this prophet's days are numbered and expected Jesus to, I don't know, curl up into a ball or retreat to a cave with a few of his disciples or find a way to just work more cooperatively with the empire. But surprise, Jesus called him a fox. Now, we think that word means sly today, like sly fox. But in the time of Jesus, to be called a fox, that was a term of contempt. Jesus and Herod would eventually come face to face, of course, when he has him arrested and then has Pilate put him on mock trial as king of the Jews. And it was a show trial. And when Jesus refused to perform any magic tricks to prove that he was the Messiah or even answer any questions, we know what happened. We know the rest of the story. Stripped naked for humiliation, wearing a crown of thorns, carrying the instrument of his own death, the state made sure that everyone knew who was in charge. Like the leading candidate of the Republican Party for president, whose response to hecklers is to say, "Get him out of here. Get him out of here." If that doesn't make a chill go up your spine, go to the doctor, have him check your chiller. But what Jesus never does is pretend you can work with those who intend to destroy you and also serve the people God has called you to serve. This is no incremental mission. This is all or nothing. That's why Pope Francis, the people's pope, made this comment recently, without precedent, that the aforementioned candidate is not a Christian. Do you remember that? The candidate called it disgraceful, of course, because he insults everyone who disagrees with him, no matter the status of that person. But what was lost in the shallow media coverage of this moment is the truth that the Pope was not attacking Trump or interjecting himself into American politics. He was defending the church. Because if you can say anything, if you can do anything, if you can be insulting and mean and then say, "Oh, and by the way, I'm a Christian," then of course being a Christian means nothing. If saying one is a good Christian means nothing in terms of one's actual behavior or treatment of other people or even the most minimal level of graciousness, then it just must be a badge. A badge of pseudo-decency worn on the sleeve of someone who wants to be president, but in so doing, the Pope rightly tells us, is using that sleeve to wipe the church itself away. I don't understand why so many evangelical Christians can ignore this fact when character and morality seem so important, the Christian virtues so important. This is astonishing to me. I can only assume that the level of hatred and fear is so advanced in parts of this country, and that so many are so eager for a strong man to scapegoat our enemies, that following Jesus ends up having absolutely nothing to do with being Christian. It's just a campaign button now, worn on the lapel of politicians who visit black churches and pretend to have rhythm. Reclaim America for Christ, they say, failing to recognize that for Jesus that meant health care for everyone who needs it and an embrace of the stranger. Show me where Jesus recommends building a wall. Show me where Jesus says let's deport the stranger. Show me where Jesus says let's ban Gentiles from entering the promised land. The church has disappeared not because we're too political, but in the best sense of the word, we're not political enough. Politicians want the church to be a kind of sentimental dispenser of charity, but never the locus of justice or revolution. That's how you claim to love Jesus while locking up Jesus. Go tell that fox for me, listen, I'm casting out demons and performing cures today, which includes people who can't afford therapy or health insurance. Today, tomorrow, and the next day, I must be on my way. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to it. And as if this wasn't strong enough, Jesus then uses one of the most overtly feminine references in all of Scripture to sharpen the contrast between himself and the fox. How often have I desired to gather your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you were not willing? And this is not the first time God's been likened to a mother hen. If you're a real Bible nerd, you know that's in 2 Esdras. 2 Esdras? That's a book not even in our Protestant Bible. But that's when the metaphor was first introduced. But when Jesus uses it, the meaning is clear because he's first referred to Herod as a fox. You guessed it, a fox in the hen house. And we know how this turns out. But this is the image that Jesus chooses. And let's face it, in the world of power, it's a loser. As Barbara Brown Taylor puts it, Jesus chooses a chicken, which is about as far from a fox as you can get. That way, the options become very clear. You can live by licking your chops, or you can die protecting the chicks. She has no fangs, no claws, no rippling muscles. All she has is her willingness to shield her babies with her own body. If the fox wants them, he'll have to kill her first, which he does, as it turns out. He slides up to her one night in the yard while all the babies are asleep, and when her cry wakens them, they scatter. She dies the next day where both foxes and chickens can see her wings spread, breast exposed, without a single chick beneath her feathers. It breaks her heart, but it does not change a thing. If you mean what you say, this is how you stand. So, dear church, dear beloved community, dear clergy friends across the country, if you mean what you say, this is how you stand. A church that winks at growing fascism has lost its soul. Jesus is not a form of neutral energy that you can use to get elected. He calls us to non-compliance with the principalities and the powers. Here we stand. This we believe. Love is better than hate. Peace is better than war, because life is better than death. Go tell that fox for me. This church is not about to march to you in your fear-mongering parade. We're not about to turn this country we love into a reality TV show. You're fired. With an enemies list and a religious test for citizenship. Go tell those twin foxes, the Koch brothers, that they have exactly 2 votes. But the rest of us, we each have 1, and there's a lot of us. Tell all the billionaires, if we're going to lose America incrementally, then just don't depend on all of us to remain silent on the way. We must be the church on our way. Our way is welcoming the stranger and tearing down the wall. We will do this unarmed and vulnerable as a hen gathers her brood under her wings. So come and get us. Come and get us if you must. We know the fate of prophets who speak truth to power. Someone always says, get him out of here. Or they crucify him. You might want to remember, Mr. Fox, how that turned out, because pride really does go before the fall. And one thing, Mr. Fox, don't even try to fire us. We don't work for you. The person we elect to be the next president of the United States, that person works for us, works for all of us. So my last word to you all is, please keep living the questions, but also please live the answers. Because we're not just fighting now for the soul of progressive Christianity. We are fighting for the soul of our country. God help us all. Amen.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information on our faith community or to support this outreach with a donation, be sure to visit us online at www.reachtouchteach.com.